This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris 1 Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Just a quick note to say that we experienced some audio issues during the recording of this episode, and our guest's voice isn't as clear as it should be. Thanks for bearing with us. In most areas of our lives, artificial intelligence is promising to bring revolutionary change, from medicine to transport, from education to food production. Even creative industries, filmmaking, music, and the visual arts will not be spared. We're all aware that we are part of a huge experiment. Indeed, we contribute willy-nilly to this new world by authorizing big tech companies to use our data and allowing their algorithms to influence what we see and what we read online. The transformations created by AI technologies are reaching deep into the makeup of our societies. How will competition for AI supremacy impact power relations between countries, particularly the US and China? What effects will it have on geopolitics, on individual freedoms, and on democratic values? To help answer these questions, Vis-a-Vis is honored to welcome Asma Mala, whose new book, Technopolitics, How Technology Turns Us into Soldiers, Technopolitique, Comment la technologie fait de nous des soldats, was published in France in February 2024. Asma Mala is a member of the Political Anthropology Research Center, Laboratoire d'Anthropologie Politique, at the French National Council for Scientific Research, and teaches at the Paris Global Center of Columbia University, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. Her work focuses on new forms of powers between states and technological giants, their impact on democratic issues and social network governance, geopolitical and ideological dimensions of AI, and technological sovereignty. Asma Mala holds a PhD from EHESS in Paris. She also advises governments and institutions on their tech policies. Asma Mala, welcome to Vis-a-Vis. At the root of your book, Technopolitics, How Technology Turns Us into Soldiers, is the idea that technology is itself a form of power. So we often tend to think that technology is neutral, but in fact, it's not simply a means towards an end. Its goal is really not just to improve efficiency, but it is a form of power in its own right. And part of the power of technology lies in the data that it collects from its users, that is, from all of us, and the algorithms that it creates in order to influence opinion and shape political debates. Your thesis in your book is that technology makes us into soldiers in this new cognitive war. What do you mean by this? And if we are the soldiers, who or what is the target?
Okay, so there's many questions in this one single first question, dear Emmanuel. I'm going to just start my answer with this power thing. Why I'm saying that technology is power is about politics, actually. Because, and you said it, and you're right, it's not neutral. And let's say that technology tools and what we call the technique conveys, actually, ideology, biases, norms, standards, uses. They are built on technological stacks. You have models trained on data sets, on algorithm models, and who? Maybe the main question is not the what, actually. It's not what is AI, what is social media, what is, you know, submarine cables or Starlink satellites. The right question is, who is building this? And what is this? And this is new forms of power. Actually, tech giants are creating probably the new foundation of our society. And it depends on their own views, on their own ideology. And the example of Elon Musk, for example, is typically what I'm saying and what I'm trying to, let's say, prove in my book. So in terms of technology, power, and I'm just going to size my answer, in terms of geopolitics, of course, AI systems are at the heart, you know, of the competition between the US and China in terms of actually military uses. And yes, of course, when you use ChatGPT, for example, or X, you're using American tools, American bases, American vision of the world. So it's a tool of what? Of hard and soft power, of course. So this is why AI systems, this is why technology in general is about power and politics. And what is pretty new here is that it's not only a matter of nation state, of empires. It's also about new actors, hybrid actors, tech giants. And they are not only private companies, they are also ideological actors, geopolitical actors, and military actors. And here's the brand new thing we have to understand the new century, actually. So here's my the first part of the answer regarding these new forms of power and technology and biases, etc. Regarding the second one, why I am saying that we are soldiers, we are civilians, because I said that we have a first super new phenomenon, tech giants as political actors, hybrid actors, okay? The second new thing is that those technologies, their technologies are double use. They are in the same time, military and civilian. And if we say that AI systems, if social media, tomorrow metaverse, or Ws, they are in the same time, military and civilian, then we citizens are soldiers. We are fighters of a new kind of war that you can't see, you can't touch, you can't feel, but it's here. It's hybrid.
And this is fascinating. I mean, when you're saying that the dimension of this relationship between big tech and big states is not only technological, but it is also military, what do you include in this? Is the military dimension one that concerns surveillance and the increased power that states will have to get deep into the personal and private lives of individuals? Or are you also talking about new forms of warfare using drones and face recognition to detect enemies and perform political assassinations and that sort of thing?
What I'm saying when I say that is that we are witnessing another, a third maybe phenomenon, but this one is not pretty new, actually. It's a kind of a new techno-military complex, right? With startups, with tech giants, working with Pentagon, working with the US Army, working with DARPA. And it's not new. We can remember, you know, the famous big discourse of Eisenhower saying, you know, be careful, but be careful of what? For our freedom, actually. But, and here we can maybe have the same warning, literally the same one. And when you just check, you know, the federal contract going to Palantir, going to SpaceX, Elon Musk, going to Andrew Real, going to Google, Alphabet, Amazon, in terms of cloud, in terms of software, in terms of warships. I mean, it's crazy. In terms of billions of dollars, the tech giants are becoming, you know, a checkpoint in the military complex of the first power of the world. And here we have another maybe issue, topic we have to discuss it, because if we don't, if we are not aware of this huge power and invisible power, then maybe we have here a democratic problem. Because, yeah, we have people with billions of dollars in contracts, maybe going to the federal state, actually. So here's my point. I'm a bit worried that we have, you know, some actors going to decide what is war, when we're going to war, how we're going to make war in the new century. And you said, it's also about AI systems on the battlefield. It's also about data. It's also about who is going to be the first to get the right data to send the bomb. And we had this dream fantasy, this goal to have, you know, the frappe chirurgicale. I don't have it in English. You know, this
surgical strikes.
Yeah. You know, this very precise strike during the war. And actually, AI just reactivates, you know, this dream of the super precise strike. But what we are witnessing right now on the current battlefield is that actually AI softwares are becoming mass destruction weapons. And the other topic we're going to have to deal with is going to be autonomous weapons. And probably it's going to be worse. And meanwhile, we have, you know, two countries, two superpowers, China and the US, trying to maintain a kind of status quo, just not taking any decision, because what is at stake here is their leadership. So they need these weapons, and they need their tech giants to fuel them, to fuel this new power. And here, yeah, it's not a matter of saying it's right or wrong. No, it's a matter of power, counter power. Citizens, we're going to discuss the kind of society we want, the kind of war, the art of war we want in terms of ethics, in terms of law, in terms of rights. And maybe to finish my answer, you mentioned, you know, facial recognition softwares and all this, you know, surveillance mechanisms and panopticon, let's say. What is pretty funny and what's going on is that when you have this power, the queen nations, if you can't use it, if you develop so many technologies in order to make war, because war is also a market, right? It's also a market with industrials, with, you know, benefits and costs and actors and markets. So when you develop all these technologies, and if we say no war, no hyper war, as Hussein and Allen, you know, wrote it, it's the concept of these two American researchers. So if we say stick to hyper wars, what are we going to do with all these technologies already developed? So probably, yes, it's going to be, you know, an internal power against citizens. And yes, it's going to fuel, you know, all the techno surveillance tools already here. So we have this combination between what is external power and internal surveillance on probably the same continuum, actually.
That's very helpful. I want to come back to the tension and the rivalry between China and the United States. But before then, I had this question about the nature of the influence of the tech industry on states and on political decisions. One particular thing that seems to me to be a big question for us is there an ideology behind these big tech companies? In other words, what are they trying to achieve? Obviously, there is a desire to dominate a market and to sell products. So there is a desire for economic dominance. But beyond that, is there an ideology that is actually driving the pursuit of effectiveness and progress on AI technologies?
Yeah. The angle of the ideology of the Silicon Valley is very interesting, because you have a part, not all big tech, not all tech giants are, you know, following this, let's say, new tendency, but some of them, probably the most powerful, S-Corp with Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, of course, you know, with this Palantir, you know, company, Horowitz and Andreessen, owners of maybe one of the most powerful VC funds, David Sachs, hosting a super influential podcast in the Valley. And some others, they are mixing many things. It's kind of patchwork of ideologies. First, they are all libertarian. They are all trying to destroy what is federal state and its bureaucracy. Okay, it's very clear. And they have a very big problem with laws and regulation because it's a kind of limit to their genius, to their ambition. I mean, they feel they are misunderstood by us, right? And by the system. So yeah, there's this libertarian ideology. And they have all read, you know, Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged, which is their Bible, actually. So here's the first maybe thing to have in mind. The second, you have a small part of those libertarians leaning to the alt-right and the MAGA universe and the MAGA galaxy in terms of values. They even call it the anti-woke capital. We have to destroy this woke virus. They completely agree with the Trump vision of the U.S. society. And third, what Musk is doing is interesting from that perspective because he's hacking the federal state, but from the inside with, you know, this new efficiency commission. It's pretty interesting to see that he's going to destroy the federal state. It's really his project, actually, but from the inside. Nothing is illegal almost here. Except maybe some conflicts of interest, but who's gonna, you know, try to fight this? So there's this historical libertarian tendency, plus this tutti walk thing, plus you have Trump, and Trump is a super great opportunity for this small group of the Silicon Valley elite, let's say. And I'm gonna just add something. In this little group, we can call it the PayPal Mafia, because they were all friends when they launched PayPal. Palantir, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, David Sachs were colleagues and friends at that time. And Peter Thiel, for example, wrote a super interesting article 20 years ago saying that democracy, that we have to destroy democracy, because democracy actually, and according to him, is actually a dictatorship of the average. And we are people, the average ones. He's opposing freedom and democracy, his freedom and our democracy. And actually, we are absolutely not sharing the same values with them. And we have to be very aware of this. And when they were just, you know, funny some years ago, now they have billions, they have technology stack, and they have power. And they have dreams. They have dreams, and we don't have dreams anymore. So maybe it's not the history of their power. It's more actually, when I think about it, the history of our weaknesses. We are not able anymore to get any empowerment, let's say, or civic engagement to have another narrative.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you're saying that we don't have dreams, it reminds me of the analysis of a German-born philosopher called Gunther Anders, who wrote in the 1950s a book called The Obsolescence of Man. And in it, he actually explains that one of the greatest challenges of our time, and he was writing in the 1950s, is the growing gap between human beings and the technology that we create. And if I can quote him, he said, instead of imagining a world that we can't yet create, we create a world that we're incapable of imagining. In other words, his analysis is that we lack imagination, and goes back to what you were saying, that maybe we fail to dream. In other words, we fail to envisage a future where technology and man can be not just complementary, but where human ideals can actually create new forms of community. So I'm curious about how you think the sense of counterbalance can actually be created. In your book, you do have a word for it. So to counterbalance big tech and big states, you talk about the notion of big citizens who can reclaim control over their freedom to think. But at the same time, if we can't dream, and if we lack the ability to envisage how technology will and can impact our future, how do we do this? How do we achieve this new sense of community?
Yeah, maybe we have two big questions to keep in mind. I don't necessarily have the answer. Bernanos was a French philosopher, and he said, you know, freedom, what for? La liberté, pourquoi faire? I want to ask you, you and our audience, technology, okay, what for? Innovation for innovation is absurd. It's a nonsense. So we have to have goals, dreams, common projects. And then maybe the right discussion is, okay, what kind of tools must achieve this global common goal? We don't even have this. So here we have a problem. Technology, what for? And second question, it's a political scientist, an American one, Ian Bremmer. I'm a super huge fan of Bremmer. And one day he was interviewed and he said, yeah, let me ask you something. Who governs? Who governs us? State, politicians, tech giants, who? We have to decide who is going to govern us. So here are, you know, the two big, maybe political, not technological, political questions. And regarding, you know, how we can deal with this and how we can do it. Here in Europe, because I'm based in Paris, I mean, we can't do anything. We have no technological sovereignty. We are just using, consuming, you know, tech, American apps and American, you know, solutions and software. So, I mean, it's very hard for us in Europe. The only maybe answer we have is legal. We have many norms and laws and et cetera. But when we come back to the US, some years ago, there was a trial between, you know, Google and Gonzalez family. And Gonzalez lost. During, you know, the trial, we have interesting debate about what is tech giant. We have a problem of the who. And if we say we have a problem with the who, then we have a problem with their status. They can't be private companies with no accountability. It's impossible. It's impossible. So they had this idea of giving them the common carrier status. I think it exists in the US. It's applied for the electricity providers. I don't know what kind of other strategic sectors. And maybe we can figure out, imagine new ways to govern them, not dismantle them. I think we're not going to do it because they are conveying soft and hard power of the US superpower. So I don't think we're going to choose this option. But why not giving them another status? And maybe with us, with citizens, with civil society, with politicians, maybe we can choose the decision, the right governance of tech giants. Because again, they are hybrid. They are not only tech private companies. So here, maybe we have another way to think with some maybe political innovation and not only technological innovation. We can innovate politically. We have to.
This is a really innovative way of thinking about regulation. It is really creating a new landscape, a new framework within which to regulate these companies. What do you think about what Europe is trying to do at the moment in terms of AI regulation? And is that not going far enough? There's a popular saying that says the US innovates, Asia replicates, and Europe regulates. Do you think there's truth in this? And I think a complementary question is there any chance for Europe and France to really fight their corner in this new global environment? And what can be done in order to support the development of tech industries in Europe and in France?
Yeah, it's not a mystery that Europe is really struggling. I mean, it's pretty hard. And why? Because we're just, you know, paying something like 40 years of no vision, no anticipation, nothing. We built Europe, you know, after the Second World War, just to preserve and maintain peace, not as a power, not as a geopolitical power. So here we are just, you know, waking up and realizing that, oh gosh, in China and in the US and in Israel. Yeah, they just built a techno power and we have not. So the first answer, the easiest one, was, you know, laws. And I know that in Europe sometimes, and even in the US, we say that, yeah, regulation is the contrary of innovation. I don't think so. Actually, the idea of Europe is to say that, guys, okay, you're American or Chinese, okay, we're fine with it. But within our borders, you're gonna respect our values, our laws, our norms, and our citizens, their freedom, and their actually rights. And it's super important in terms of political signal to say that, hey, we don't have the tech giants, we don't have the equivalent of these new creators, we don't have the proactive industrial, you know, vision. We can't leverage. It's super hard for us to think on the long run, actually. So, here we have to work. We really have to work. And maybe to be more pragmatic, you have two gigantic models, the US and China's ones, with tech giants, etc. And with, you know, the federal state, and even in China, the PCC, really having kind of a state capitalism, let's say. They intervene, actually, in their tech policies. It's absolutely not that liberal, right? And maybe in Europe, we have to imagine this third way, not being necessarily a power, but just working on our local scale, you know, with big cities, with our cities, on trying to maybe imagine, figure out, what is to live together with this technology? What is our project? And maybe we can here have many things to do.
Right. Well, on that note, Asma, I'd like to thank you. You've given us a great deal to think about. You've given us reasons to be fearful, of course, but thankfully also reasons to be hopeful. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us.
Thank you, Manuel.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris-Panthéon-Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Monica Hunter-Hart and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook, Twitter X, and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.